This is an Australian Museum podcast. Welcome to Live Talks at the AM, recorded in front of a live audience at the Australian Museum in Sydney.
Oh, good morning, everybody. Good morning, Professor Burke. How are you? Yeah, I'm very well. Thanks. Nice to see you all. Thanks for coming out on a Saturday morning. We've got a fantastic hour or so to spend together this morning talking about one of those fascinations that despite what you think you don't know enough. You know, it's one of those things we all have a touch point on with ancient Egypt, and we have an expert in the room who's going to lead us into that in the most beautiful way possible. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we're on Gadigal land, part of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging as the traditional custodians of knowledge in this place. And I think for an architecture kind of focused talk, especially one about ancient architecture, just the idea of in this place is everything you need to take away from that kind of acknowledgement of country. This is about being in a place for thousands of years. 3,000 years is what we're going to be talking about today. 65,000 years for our Indigenous cultures here in Australia. So we're very fortunate to be able to take that perspective, I think, and we should all be a bit humbled by what that all really means. So just to kind of give you an idea about what's going on today, firstly, my name is Anthony Burke. I'm a professor of architecture at UTS, and it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm as fascinated about this topic as you are, and I can't wait to hear what Gillian has to tell us. We're going to hear from Gillian for about 30 minutes, 35 minutes or so. Then she and I are going to have a little chat just down here in the front. I've got some questions that I want to ask. And then we're going to throw to you to ask some questions and she will answer your questions. So as she's talking today, think up some of the things you might want to ask. For me, the first Egyptologist I've met in person, so I'm sure you have a couple of really specific questions for our expert in the room. So with that, I should also say today's lecture is presented by the Australian Museum's Public Programs team in partnership with Macquarie University, and we are recording this lecture today, so maybe just that might be useful to keep in mind when you're thinking of the questions you'd like to ask. You're being recorded, you know. So to introduce our very special guest this morning, Dr. Gillian Smith. She got her PhD from Macquarie University in 2021, not that long ago, but she's been making much of that expertise since. She's an Egyptologist. She specialises in temple architecture and art of the Ramesside period. Her thesis, which is currently being turned into a publication, which I'm sure we're all very expectant for, is about traditional Egyptological and art historical theories. And this is why I'm interested. She combines that with architectural theory as well. Her thesis was specifically around the hypostyle hall at Karnak Temple. So, you know, this is, you know, just to put this in context, you know, as someone who teaches architectural history, this is one of the second or third lectures you get when you start architecture. You know, you learn about, you know, ancient Egyptian architecture and you get introduced to the hypostyle hall, and from there everything unfolds. So this is, you know, this is ground zero. Gillian has been on archaeological field teams. She's been a member of the Macquarie University Theban Tombs project. She's completed her own field research at Karnak Temple in Luxor, and she has an interest in public engagement. Gillian was just talking to, where is she? She was just talking to me earlier about her interest in making sure that the communication of these really amazing academic ideas and expertise is a big part of the agenda for academia going forward, and it's something that really fires her up, and that's why she's here, part of why she's here today. So I also found out very recently that Gillian was the winner of the 3-Minute Thesis Award at Macquarie University and went on, I think this is the biggest accolade in her arsenal, went on to be the People's Choice Award for the Asia Pacific 3-Minute Thesis Award in 2021. How excellent is that? So with no further ado, please welcome Gillian Smith.
Thank you. Thanks, Anthony, and thank you to the Australian Museum for having me here today. And thank you to everyone here who has attended this talk. This is a topic that I love talking about, and I hope that by the end of this, you guys love it as well. So as an Egyptologist, upon meeting someone, one of the first things that I'm always sure to be asked about is how the Egyptians built the pyramids. What were they used for? And am I sure about that? These absolutely remarkable and beautiful monuments have captured humanity's attention since they were first built thousands of years ago. For the ancient Egyptians, they represented the power and the piety of the king, as well as the wealth and prosperity of their nation. In modern times, they represent the scope of human thought and skill. And while these are the buildings that we first think about when we think about Egyptian architecture, they are in no way the limit of what was conceived or engineered. Egyptian architecture is a monumental topic. Over the course of Egyptian history, we see great variation in the materials used, their engineering methods, the decoration, and the use of these spaces. As modern scholars, each space, regardless of the state of its archaeological remains, offers us a wealth of information about this civilization and a uniquely interesting story about the people who interacted with these spaces. One of the most fascinating aspects of Egyptian architecture is how they utilized the environment to create spaces that were highly symbolic, but also suited their practical needs. So narrowing down this topic to fit into 1 hour is quite the task. And this is particularly so given that the Ramesside period is characterized by prolific building campaigns. Today, we're going to concentrate on just one type of building, the Egyptian temple, which was of great importance both religiously but also politically. We're going to dive into 2 examples, the Karnak temple complex and Abu Simbel, which, for reasons that will become very clear to you, are amongst the most iconic of Egyptian monuments, and which both harnessed the environment in very different ways. So temples, they were first and foremost spaces for religious activity. Each one is dedicated to a particular deity or a small group of deities. They were divine and sacred spaces, and they were considered the earthly dwelling place for the gods. In fact, the terms that we use for temple in ancient Egyptian are house and mansion. In the innermost part of the temple was the divine sanctuary, and this is where a statue of the deity would be kept. This statue would be made of gold or other precious materials, and it was towards this that all cultic activity was centered. So you can see there on the left of the screen, we have the inner sanctuary at the Karnak temple complex. It's small and dark, and right there in the center is the altar where the god statue would have been kept. Unfortunately, we have no surviving examples of these statues. Rather, we only have the depictions of them, which you can also see there on the screen. As divine and pure spaces, access to the temple was limited to only those in the priesthood and the uppermost echelons of society. In fact, it was only the king himself or his priest who's stepping into his role who was allowed into that innermost sanctuary, which would maintain the purity of that space. On festival occasions, when the statue might be taken out of that space, it would be taken on a portable shrine, which was kept hidden with a veil concealing it from the mundane world. And we can see an example of what this would have looked like in ancient times here. So this is a line drawing of a relief carving in Karnak Temple. And right there in the center is the portable shrine. So we don't actually get to see the god himself, but we do get to see what that might have looked like in ancient times. So this stark contrast between the divine world of the gods and the mundane world in which it was built is materialized in both the architecture as well as the decoration of the temple. We have large enclosure walls surrounding the temple grounds, blocking its access to the common people. We have large open spaces towards the outer periphery of the temple, so courtyards. And then as we get progressively closer into that inner sanctuary, the rooms get smaller and smaller. We even see things like the floor rising in elevation or the roof being lowered in height, creating progressively smaller, more intimate, and importantly, more exclusive spaces. Then at the heart of the temple, we have our inner sanctuary. So we have a few examples here. We've got Medinet Habu, which is located in Luxor, built by Ramses III. And around the edge there, I hope you can see the big mud brick outer enclosure wall. Then we've got the big pylons out the front with courtyards. And then, unfortunately, the roof no longer exists towards the back of the temple. But you'll just have to trust me, there would have been a roof. A nice schematic diagram showing us this change in elevation is here at Khonsu Temple, again located in Luxor. So there you can see the roof gets lowered the closer we get to towards the back of the temple, but the floor also rises in slight elevation. The photo down the bottom there is a reconstruction of the Karnak Temple complex, which shows you what it would have looked like, how busy it was, and how many different buildings there were in this space. So, now that we have an understanding of the Egyptian temple, let's look at some great examples. So perhaps the most significant temple in Egyptian history is the Karnak Temple complex, and a personal favorite of mine. Karnak is the largest temple in Egyptian history. At its peak, the temple precinct would have stretched on for over a kilometer. And today, it still stands remarkably well preserved as one of the most popular tourist sites in Egypt. The complex is located on the east bank of the Nile in Luxor, or what would have been referred to as Thebes in ancient times. We have evidence of religious buildings dedicated to the sun god Amun-Ra at the site as far back as the reign of Intef II, who ruled approximately 2100 BCE. But it's likely that there was even older buildings at the site before that. As well as being the largest, we also know that Karnak was one of the most politically important royal buildings in use, and that is because it was in use consistently for more than 2,000 years. Almost every king since Intef II contributed in some way to the building program or decorative program here. During the New Kingdom in particular, we see rapid periods of construction, deconstruction, and renovation at the site. This, of course, poses a massive challenge for modern scholars as we try to reconstruct the history and the evolution of this space. It's very common for us to see kings dismantling older structures and then reusing that same stone in their own buildings, or even just carving over the names of people and putting their own there. What we see today is a very static version of a dynamic monument. It would have looked radically different during different times of its history. What this dynamicism tells us is that the dedication of a building campaign at Karnak was a key aspect in the kings asserting their power, particularly during the later Egyptian Empire. The dedication of a building program here was almost a necessity for these kings. If the importance of Karnak as more than a religious hub needs any more justification, we could indeed look to the fact that it remained in use and was being added to and restored well and truly into the Greco-Roman period. We have evidence of kings such as Philip Arrhidaeus, Alexander the Great's father, building at this space. And then, later again, parts of the temple were reused as Coptic churches in the 3rd century AD, before eventually the temple fell into disuse. The sprawling remains that you can see there on the screen are a result of excavations that began in the late 1800s and a dedication campaign which is ongoing still today. Every time you go back to visit the space, it looks so different. They're doing incredible work there. So the main temple at Karnak is dedicated to the god Amun-Ra. He's one of the most important gods of ancient Egypt. He's thought to be a creator god responsible for bringing the world into being and was considered the divine father of the king. He's a solar deity, and he's specifically associated with the rising sun. So like most religions, For the ancient Egyptians, the connection between their mythology and their environment is strong. And often, their architecture either mimics nature or they manipulate the environment around them to emphasize this. In the case of Karnak, the whole temple is built on an east-west axis with a central pathway starting at the west, where you approach the temple from, and going through to the east at the back of the temple. Now, not only is the temple built on this axis, but the original building at the site was built in exact alignment with the rising of the sun on the occasion of the winter solstice, which happens roughly around the 22nd of December each year. This alignment was honored by all further additions to the temple, and the effect it creates is phenomenal. When you're standing at the entrance to the temple on the morning of the winter solstice, the sun disk appears as though it is rising directly out of the temple. As though the god lives within the temple and is coming up. The awe-inspiring effect that this must have had on the pious population of Egypt cannot be overstated. Indeed, even today, hundreds of people gather each year to watch this phenomenon, and it truly does not disappoint. So as we look at those images, one thing is important for us to keep in mind. The temple would have looked very different in ancient times. Today, we don't have the roof structures of most buildings, unfortunately. So we need to keep in mind that while we have a very clear path and you can see the sun rising up through those doorways, the ancient Egyptians may not have been able to see that. What they may have seen is simply the sun coming up out of the temple. Nonetheless, it's pretty cool. Now, while I think that this is a bit of a highlight of any visit to Egypt or to Karnak, as visitors wander through the complex maze of courtyards, halls, and chapels, another standout feature is without a doubt the famous Hypostyle Hall. And it provides us another connection between the architecture and the environment. So at its time of construction, the Hypostyle Hall marked the entrance into the temple. The physical construction of this space is attributed to Seti I, Ramesses II's father. And it's thought, based on the carving style used, as well as administrative documents that we've found at the temple, it might have taken roughly 10 years to construct. The decoration of the hall, however, took much, much longer. Seti I is responsible for the decoration in the northern half of the hall, but unfortunately, he couldn't get any further when he died, and then Ramesses II completed the rest of the decoration. About 100 years later, though, Ramesses IV came through and he added a bunch of different decoration as well. So we can see that it was in use for a really long time, or under construction and decoration for a really long time. So built between two ginormous pylons in the east and west, the hall covers a rectangular area about 103 meters by 53 meters wide. So roughly a little bit smaller than a football field. Along the east-west processional path, which marks the central axis of the temple, are six pairs of columns, each reaching 21 meters high. These tall columns are marked by their large capitals, which imitate the shape of an open papyrus flower. Parallel to these, but more densely set, in both the northern and the southern parts of the hall, are 61 small columns. And you can see those in the center of the screen there. These reach 13 meters high, which bring the total number of columns in the hall to 134. These smaller columns are also decorated with capitals, which resemble a closed bud papyrus flower. The bases, as well as the capitals, are also decorated with plant motifs, making the hall, quite literally, a forest of columns. Filling that difference in height between the taller columns and the shorter ones is a clerestory structure, which forms a central nave through the space. The clerestory is composed of two rows of massive slit windows, with each window being 5 metres high. So this means that the roof of the central nave sits at just more than 26 metres. It was these windows that would provide a filtered light into the hall, as well as small light wells that would be sporadically cut into the roofing slabs. It's worth noting that the hall is completely unique in Egyptian history. While columned halls are common, we never see one again at this scale, nor do we see a clerestory windows being in the central nave of a space. It's never repeated, and was never done previously, as far as we're aware. The physical construction of this space created an interesting sensory experience for visitors. It's cool, dark, and eerily quiet. Large wooden doors would have blocked light from entering, and while the clerestory windows bring in some light, the columns actually largely block this from reaching beyond that central pathway. The small light wells in the roofing slabs provide only sporadic spotlights. If the space was to be well lit, it would have been by an enormous number of oil lamps placed on the floor, casting dramatic shadows across the walls and columns of this space. The lack of light, as well as the sandstone material, created a space which offered cool relief from the harsh desert environment outside. The large columns also block sound from traveling throughout the hall, despite it being an enclosed space. The effect created by the physicality of the hall and furthered by the decoration, which is a topic for a different day, is that the forest of columns imitates and acts as a stone version of the papyrus marshes along the Nile River. Mythologically, the papyrus marsh surrounded the primordial hill from which all life began. It represents a place of birth, life, and goodness, similar to the inner sanctuary of the temple. The papyrus marsh was also where the god Horus was kept hidden as he was growing up. When he emerged from the marsh, he assumed his role as the king of Egypt. And in this way, we see the marsh as a place of safety and transition. In the real world, the papyrus marsh serves as a liminal zone of the landscape, physically marking the boundary between the aquatic and terrestrial environments. In this way, we see architecture and mythology is used to create a very specific, symbolically rich experience for the visitors of the temple. The hypostyle hall can be understood to act as a permeable boundary between the secular and the divine world inside the temple. It mimics the papyrus marsh in mythology, but it also reflects the real world of the ancient Egyptians. This is just one example of how the Egyptians utilized their landscape and world around them in their buildings. Providing us a very different example is the Temple of Abu Simbel. So unlike Karnak, which stands close to the modern village and whose towering pylons and columns had largely been visible for centuries, Abu Simbel was located in the remote south of Egypt, about 3 hours south of Aswan and close to where the modern day border with Sudan is. During ancient times, this area was known as Nubia and is characterized by being a harsh desert environment. The two temples composing the site do not stand freeform, but rather are cut into the sandstone mountain. Now, such a remote location may seem like a strange choice for a temple. However, we must remember that while religious, these temples were also symbols of the king's power and presence throughout the land. The area of Nubia was not always in Egyptian control, and so these temples were important in maintaining the king's presence, controlling the people of that area, and importantly, Egyptianizing the Nubians. Certainly, this symbolism still holds today, with the face of with the facade of Abu Simbel being used as an image of the king's power and strength as you walk into the exhibition outside. So the temples of Abu Simbel were built by Ramesses II early on in his reign. The larger of the two, which is the one directly above my head there, was dedicated to the divine manifestation of the king. That is, the king in his role as the divine son of Amun-Ra. The second smaller temple is dedicated in honor of his wife Nefertari. Now, as an ancient structure, Abu Simbel is a fascinating site and a marvel of engineering. But its modern history is also rather impressive. So unlike Karnak, Abu Simbel did not remain in use for a long time following its construction. The desert reclaimed it, and the facade became completely covered in sand. While visitors to the area were told by locals of stories of great temples built in the space, their exact location was unknown. And by the time of its European rediscovery in 1813, the temple was almost all but forgotten. Since then, efforts to excavate and conserve the site have been ongoing. Due to the remote desert location, the temple was not even fully excavated until the early 1900s. And you can see a wonderful illustration dating to around 1840 by David Roberts, who was very famous. He did a massive trip through Egypt and illustrated a lot of these sites. And we can see that while they'd cleared some of the sand, they actually hadn't even reached inside the temple yet. So inside was also filled up with sand. They had no idea about the extent of this temple yet. So that was its early history. But later on, the temple was under threat again, this time from flooding due to the proposed construction of the Aswan High Dam. In the 1950s, the Egyptian government decided to replace the small dam at Aswan with a larger, much needed one. The new high dam would allow Egypt to control the yearly flooding, as well as provide a much needed source of hydropower for the country. The problem with the construction of the high dam was that as a byproduct, it would create a massive artificial lake known as Lake Nasser. And this would stretch on for almost 500 kilometers in the south of Egypt. And it would flood a number of historical sites, including Abu Simbel. In response to this, UNESCO and the Egyptian government undertook a 20-year campaign from 1960 to 1980 to salvage and relocate 22 ancient monuments. Abu Simbel was identified as a priority for the temple and was the first to be relocated. The mountainside, which the temple was cut into, was quite literally cut into strategically into movable sized blocks. And the temple was then reassembled 180 meters inland and at a raised elevation of 64 meters. An artificial mountain was then built around it. In 1968, the temple was once again open to visitors. So inside the exhibition, you'll see a model of Abu Simbel. And if you're not already impressed by what they did, I think the scale of that the monument will become clear to you when you're looking at that model. Also, if you look at the video, the picture there, just the size of the humans in comparison to the stone or to the colossi that they're reassembling is, well, crazy. So the colossal statues of Ramesses II that adorned the facade of the larger temple are each 22 meters high. And the carving of both the facade and the interior is intricate. Along with the large colossi of the king outside the temple, you can also see smaller figures of his mother and his wife next to him. In between his legs are smaller yet figures of his sons and daughters. Above the entrance is a massive niche which holds a personification of the king's name. You cannot miss that this temple belongs to Ramesses II. Now, you might also note that one of the southern colossi are missing its head, and it lies in massive stone blocks at the foot of the temple. To confirm, this damage was not done in part in the relocation. In ancient times, an earthquake severely damaged the temple. The northern colossi were also damaged, but they were restored in the reign of Seti II, which is Ramesses II's grandson. During the relocation of the temple, the broken pieces were also moved, but they were put back in the exact location they were when the temple was first excavated. As this temple is rock cut, it doesn't follow that standard plan of a temple that we saw at Karnak. But it still does consist of a series of halls and chambers that were cut into the mountain and then filled with statues and pillars. So you can see in the middle there, we've got a schematic diagram of what the temple actually looks like. And once again, we've got a clear pathway through that central axis. And the inner sanctuary is that smaller space right at the very back. So the first hall is lined by 8 square pillars with standing statues of the king attached. That these were carved out of the mountain is remarkable. The skill of the artisans is made even more abundantly clear when you enter the side chambers of the temple, which show extremely poor quality rock. In fact, a lot of these side chambers were not even completed. Adorning the walls are reliefs carved into the rock, and they're brightly painted. That was one thing that the sand filling the temple actually did us a favor in. It's actually a really good way to preserve color. And you can see that in that far image. If you look at the roof, you can still see how much the color and how like deep and rich it was. Now, not that we need to, but to make things even more impressive, the temple needed to be, when it was relocated, it needed to be done so in precise alignment to its original location. And this was in order to preserve the solar alignment of the larger temple. So, like all temples, this one was built on a central axis, which had a direct path from the entrance through a series of halls to that inner sanctuary. The pathway, once again, runs east-west, and it would have been marked by a series of doorways. At Abu Simbel, the inner sanctuary held 4 seated statues that were cut into the rock in the back wall of the room. In the center, we see, in alignment with that central axis, we see the god Amun-Ra, and he's the figure with the tall feather hat on. Next to him sits the king, Ramesses II. On the far left, we have the god Ptah, and on the far right, we have the god Ra-Horukhti. Now, for most of the year, these figures would sit hidden in the dark at the back of the temple, except on 2 days, February the 20th, which was just a few days ago, and October 20th. When the rising sun was in exact alignment with the temple and this central axis, if the doorways were left open, the sun would stream in and it would perfectly illuminate the statues of the sun god Amun-Ra and his son Ramesses II. Almost as if the sun disk itself was blessing the relationship between the king and the god. Now, as the sun continues to rise, it moves subtly to the south, and the stream of light now also illuminates the god Ra-Horukhti, a deity whose name means Horus, son of god of the horizon. On the far left, Ptah had associations with death and the afterlife, and therefore his statue would remain hidden in the dark and not touched by the life-giving force of the sun. Now, the significance of these 2 dates on which this phenomenon occurs is not fully known to us. The 2 dates are equidistant, from the winter solstice, but they do not mark a particularly important date in the Egyptian calendar. From what we can tell, it has been assumed that there must be some sort of relationship between these 2 days and significant events in the life of Ramesses II. Perhaps, for example, the date in February marks his birth and the date in October marked his coronation. However, this has not been confirmed, and given the accuracy of the Egyptian calendar, it would be unlikely that we could determine this with any real certainty. It is possible that these dates were not specifically important, but rather it was simply the act of the sun illuminating the statues which held significance. That the phenomenon happens twice, or that the dates are on equidistant from the winter solstice, may simply be inevitable or a coincidence. But certainly, that idea would have spoken to the Egyptians' fondness for duality and symmetry. So, today, we have visited 2 of the most iconic sites in Egypt. We've seen how Egyptian architecture manipulated the landscape and nature around them to create buildings which were imbued with symbolism. Not only is their monumental size awe-inspiring for ancient visitors, but the sophistication of their design created spaces which formed specific sensory and symbolic experiences, which tied together religious piety and reverence for the king. That still today, hundreds of thousands of tourists each stop and stand in awe amongst the columns of the hypostyle hall, and that hundreds gather at the entrance of Abu Simbel at sunrise to witness the lighting of the temple is truly a testament to the power and the ingenuity of ancient Egyptian civilization.
Would you like to join
me? Yes, please.
Gillian, that's amazing. Thank you so much for that talk. I had no idea. I mean, obviously, I can see what gets you out of bed in the morning. Like, this is just endlessly fascinating. Mm. But how did you... My first question is just a bit of context. How did you fall into this? Like, what started this for you, this journey?
I think probably everyone in this room, I loved Egypt as a little kid. I can remember in year 3, very specifically, we were making papyrus, which was really just like a flattened paper mache sort of mess, but I loved it. I really loved it. That year for my birthday, my mum gave me the Egyptology book with the gold cover that, yeah, we're all nodding along, we've all seen that. I was obsessed with it. I was hooked. And then when I found out that you could study Egyptology specifically and not just ancient history, dream come true.
I mean, but it's not the kind of like the... Well, it's a career choice. It's a passion you follow. Is there a lot of work out there for Egyptologists?
Honestly, not really. especially in Australia. We are really lucky in Australia, though. I will say we have a very strong Egyptology presence. Macquarie is internationally recognised in the field, which is... They've done great work for so many years. Yeah, but yeah, there aren't a lot of jobs around, but that's okay. We can do things for passion.
I think part of your experience, which is so wonderful, is you've spent time on an archaeological dig. Can you just, for us in the room who have not done that, give us a sense of what a day on the dig feels like?
Yeah, definitely. It's very fun. So the dig that I did was located in Luxor in an area called Drabu El Naga. And Macquarie's been working on this project for more than 30 years. They're excavating tombs, which were already excavated in the early 1900s. However, they weren't actually recorded. So it's really a re-recording process and a re-excavation process, which is quite interesting. Get up early, try and beat the sun, and you finish work early to get out of that sun. It's really cool. A lot of the time, you're not just digging. I think digging's probably actually one of the things you do the least of. It's really actually the interpretation and the recording of these items that you find. It's quite an affecting kind of job to do as well, because as you're sitting there and you're putting back together broken pieces of pottery, like it's a puzzle, it's kind of, you're sitting there and you're thinking, this is a jar that used to hold water or flour for the ancient Egyptians, it didn't really mean much. It's like us having a plate or a bowl in our houses. And yet here I am, 3,000 years later, spending 3 days just trying to make sure that these two pieces fit and thinking that this is the most important thing that I'm ever going to do in my life. I think that connection between humanity is probably like the most special thing about being on site.
That's amazing. That's amazing. One of the things, well, to get back to the examples you gave us, Karnak and Abu Simbel, one of the things that you made very clear is this symbolic relationship that the architecture has to its place, to the gods, to the king. I'm wondering how well all of that symbolism translated to the everyday person on the street. Mm. Would that person, that Egyptian, know what they were looking at when they saw all of that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And we, due to the nature of Egyptian evidence, we actually don't really have the perspective of common people recorded anywhere, which is a huge gap for us. So really what we can do is assume. I think a lot of the time, I think it's pretty hard to miss these ideas of, you know, massive pictures of the king in war scenes, like the Battle of Kadesh. It's hard to miss the symbolism there. Yeah. This king is powerful and this king is keeping you safe. So everything that you make or you build is in dedication to this person. More subtly, things like the open papyrus columns and things like that, it's hard to know. But it is, I think the sensory experience is probably the thing that was most important, is that sort of like, it makes you stop. I think if anyone's been to Karnak, it's not a space that you rush through. It's even, you know, without its roof and its colour preservation and things, it's a space that is really affecting. And I think it certainly had to have been for the ancient Egyptians. We're also too, we come at it from such a different perspective, where we're used to big buildings. We walk through spaces, you know, and we are in a city surrounded by skyscrapers and things. For the Egyptians, they're in a desert environment. There's nothing else that is of that scale. So it's definitely an affecting building.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Hypostyle Hall in particular and all of those amazing hieroglyphs on the, what did you say, 134 columns?
Yeah.
134 columns.
Yeah.
Amazing. So on all of those columns and reaching, of course, right up to 21 metres tall, I guess what's the, how do we think of that hall? Is it sort of, is it an archive or is it a billboard?
Yeah, great question. I think the other thing we've got to remember is that common people weren't interacting with this space. This space was built for the priesthood and it was built for the gods. When we look at what the decoration actually is in the Hypostyle Hall, it's very specific. We see a really great collection of images and rituals that mark the king's life. And essentially what we can determine is that on the outer walls we see everyday interactions, so rituals, so things that the king would have been partaking in. We see his coronation, we see festival processions. Then on the columns, we see only offering scenes. So it's just the king making offerings to the one god, Amun-Ra, again and again and again, almost as if he's saying, I am doing this in perpetuity. Like, this is, I've given you, I will give this god everything we have in Egypt. Then when we get up to the clerestory structure, we see very simplistic decoration of just the king and the god standing side by side. And that we've got to remember that that space too is brightly lit because of the sun, almost as if to say, this is the exclusive relationship between the king. So I think it is a billboard in a way of saying, this is the relationship between king and god. And anyone who's walking through that space is reminded that it is through the king that they have access to this god. It's through the king that they have access to the wealth of Egypt. So it really is. I mean, as much as the temple is a space for the god, it's a space about the king.
Yeah, yeah. Just to change gears for a second then and bring it back to, I think you said it was like the 1960s when we started, when people started talking about moving Abu Simbel up the hill.
Yeah.
Up the hill 64 metres?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, that's kind of crazy talk when I hear, I hear the scale and the precision and the complexity of a project like that. I mean, can you just tell me a little bit about what was the What was the reaction to that moment when people said, well, we're either going to lose this, you know, amazing monument underwater, or we're going to cut it up into little pieces and move it up the hill?
Yeah. What's crazy is that they'd started building the dam before they started moving the monuments. So it was this huge time pressure too, like, we have to move these now or they are gone. And we'd already seen, this wasn't the first time that this had happened, when they built the small dam at Aswan, that also flooded a number of ancient monuments in Aswan itself. And so these monuments were already underwater. Like, with the flooding, it'd go up and down, so sometimes you could walk through it, but sometimes we have pictures of people in boats, like, floating through the Temple of Philae. Like, it's wild. So we'd... like, it is crazy. So we'd seen the damage that had done to monuments. And even today, when you go visit the temples at Philae, you can see the water line of where the water went up to. So it damaged these monuments. We also already had an issue with the salt in the ground rising up into sandstone monuments and damaging them, but they had that problem in ancient times too. You see like Ptolemaic restoration of like the bottoms of like foundations and things, which is really cool. But to get back to the original question, I'd have loved to have been in that first meeting where someone said, why don't we move them? Could we do that?
Yeah. Hey, let's move the Opera House.
Yeah. Exactly. Why?
Just cut it up into little bits and move it up a little bit.
But what's
the chorus beat.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that project, it was a UNESCO project, but also in partnership with the Egyptian government. But it was funded by a number of different, I think it was like up to 20 different countries funded this project. The workforce came from all around the world. It was an absurd amount of money that they spent. I think I read the other day, I think it was like $80 billion or something like that they spent doing this, which is, wild. So I think it was a joint, this is, as much as it's Egyptian culture and it's Egyptian heritage, we share in culture across the world. And I think that's a real moment where everyone came together to do that.
Last question for me before I throw to you, dear audience. I spent a fair bit of time thinking about restoration in architecture. And there's a school of thought which is about the preciousness and maintaining that architecture, those buildings, in as authentic or original condition as possible.
Yeah.
But everything you've told us today is that this is a dynamic, era on era, king on king, moving monuments up hills to avoid dams. This is a lively scene. Mm-hmm. So how do you think of this idea of preservation and historic preservation and renovation, I suppose, or restoration with the Egyptologist's hat on?
Yeah, it's tricky. It is tricky, especially because, you see a place like Karnak and you want to see what it looks like, but how do you pick what version of it that we see? They do incredible work. There's a French-Egyptian mission that is based at Karnak, and they do phenomenal work of putting this temple back together. They've come up with some really clever ways around that too. So, for example, they might put the blocks back in one way, but they'll also do a reconstruction of like an earlier version so that you can see them side by side what different versions of it looked like. I think it's tricky too because we think this is a history that goes so far, but it will go on. If we treat this right and if we preserve it and conserve it correctly, it will go on. And someone else will be looking back at the time that we interacted with this space, and that might be that's a new history for it. I think that's the coolest thing about history is that it never stops. It just keeps going. And that it is dynamic, and the more we learn, the more our ideas can change and they can adapt. And as long as we keep doing that, I think we're probably on the right path.
Yeah. Fantastic. Great answer. Thank you. And I just think we should thank Gillian for such a great talk this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you to the museum, thank you to Liz, and thank you to Yasmin, who's been doing some fabulous work all morning. See you next time.
This has been an Australian Museum podcast.